8 high. All right, we're going to get started. I'm Alice Kim. I'm the director of the Public Square, which is a program of the Illinois Humanities Council. Yep. And I know, right? Easy applause. We're a program of the Illinois Humanities Council, and we create spaces for public conversations like the one we're having tonight. So where should I go? All right, so we're so thrilled about tonight's conversation with Vijay Prashad about his new book, Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. It's right here, and we have lots of copies for sale if you'd like to buy one. Last February, when Egyptians began to gather in Tahrir Square, the protests really captured the imagination of people all around the world. As Vijay says in his book, though, this was not simply a protest to scream into the wind, but a protest to actually remove autocrats from their position of authority. In his book, Vijay scrutinizes Western interpretations of Arab Spring. He looks at the forces on the ground that gave way to the insurrections in the Arab world. He also takes a close look at NATO's intervention in Libya, questioning their stated humanitarian motives. So I think it's particularly apt that we're having this discussion tonight on the eve of NATO. Vijay offers us a deeper analysis of Arab Spring, not just what happened, but why. So tonight, he is going to talk about his book for about 30 minutes. Then we're going to invite Adam Green, who is a historian. He's an associate professor at the University of Chicago in American History, and he's going to be in conversation with Vijay. And at that point, we're going to make some connections to the protests that are happening this weekend and also other local struggles that are happening here in Chicago. So before I invite Vijay up, I just want to thank High Concepts Lab. And Molly, are you here somewhere? Yeah, for opening up their beautiful space to us, right? I mean, this is such a great space to be in. I also want to thank the Jane Addams Hull House for partnering with us on this program, and in particular, I want to thank Molly, Lisa Lee, Harishi Patel, and Paula Bowie. So without any further ado, Vijay.
Thank you so much. Do I have to use the microphone?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, then I'll have to sit down. Okay, it might be better for me. Thank you so much, Alice, for putting it together. Lisa, Barbara, Bernadine, Bill, Adam, Harish, thank you. This is like it's almost like coming into my family to explain that I have written a new book. And hoping that they'll still like me at the end of it. So if I try to be, you know, somebody who's seeking the forgiveness and love of his family, you'll forgive me in advance. Okay, so, you know, for the last 10, 15 years, I don't know how many of you have friends in the Arab world. Occasionally, once in a while, you're friendly with somebody. 10, 15 years. I've been asking my friends, what's wrong with you people? How do you tolerate these fellows? How do you tolerate? I mean, it's a joke. How do you tolerate Mubarak? It's a joke. How can you tolerate Ben Ali? How do you tolerate these kings in Saudi Arabia? I mean, one after the other. How is this something that you put up with? And they'll all joke and say, just wait. When it happens here, it's going to be a shock to you. Because we don't do anything in half measures. You know, when we make alcohol, we make arak. When we make sweets, we make it with so much sugar that your whole body shakes. It's not going to come in half measures. Just wait. My God, when those demonstrations began. Now, to be fair, I have followed the developments. I remember, of course, in 2003, many of us were looking at anti-Iraq war demonstrations in New York, London, Rome. How many people looked in Cairo? Magnificent demonstration against the Iraq war, out of which emerged a youth movement. If you just went a few years before that, magnificent demonstration in solidarity with the Second Intifada across Egypt. I'm just talking about Egypt now. across Egypt. Little groups were formed. Then in 2006, in the massive textile factory town of Mahalla, big strike, 20,000 workers went on strike. I mean, this has been happening for a while in Tunisia. It was the mining district. But I mean, there are struggles. That doesn't mean it's as sweet as baklava, you know. It wasn't that dramatic. You still had Mubarak. In fact, you still had Mubarak, and the Americans were still saying, he's such a good guy. You know, right till the day he decided to go to the seaside, Obama was saying, you know, he's a good guy. He's not a bad guy. He's our guy. He's a good guy. He's trying his best. Right till the end. I don't know how many of you remember Sarkozy and Ben Ali. Right till the end, Ben Ali, good guy. Speaks French. He won the Legion d'Honneur. What can be worse than Ben Ali? Sophisticated. But these guys are gangsters. And then when it fell apart, because we are American, we had to say, it can't be the Arabs. Because Arabs can't do this. Arabs can't overthrow governments. It has to be Americans. It has to be Facebook. It has to be Twitter. Arabs can't do these things. We had to have been the ones. The Arabs just had to pretend to be Americans, tweeting their revolution, Facebooking their revolution. It had to be Zuckerberg and his pals who actually overthrew. And Wael, you know, who stands in for Zuckerberg. He's your Kyrian Zuckerberg, right? It's got to be Americans. It has to be Professor Gene Sharp. Remember this article in the New York Times? Professor Gene Sharp wrote a manual on nonviolent disobedience, translated into Arabic. Wow! And it was handed out by USAID. It had to be the American. It could not have been, because Arabs don't know how to act politically. You know, they like to hang around on the street, shisha, you know, chatting all the time. But then America came into their hearts. They got to this. It's a ridiculous narrative. So one of the reasons I desperately wanted to write this book was to say, that is the stupidest thing ever. That is the stupidest story. Because, by the way, Mubarak cut off the internet. He stopped the internet and the demonstrations grew bigger. It was another story. A story that obviously is not going to get remembered. So part of it was a little challenge. First point, the Arabs actually did it. That's the first lesson of my book. This is actually an Arab revolt, believe it or not. It had very little to do with Facebook. It had something to do with it, because guess what? The Russian Revolution would not have happened without the telephone. I can imagine a New York Times article, October 1917. Alexander Graham Bell produced the Russian Revolution. Obviously, you use methods of communication, the telex, you know, smoke signals, whatever the hell techniques of communication you have, you use. But you are using them. You are acting politically through technology. Technology doesn't have politics like that. Technology has politics. It can frame certain politics. It can de-socialize you into silos. It can do those things, of course. But technology doesn't act itself, not yet. Until we make robots that can actually come and smash us. Facebook didn't make the thing happen. That's lesson A, okay? Lesson B. Lesson B was too convenient for the State Department. Lesson B was, look, we have, and this, by the way, is a favorite story from Tel Aviv, which is the only democracy in the Middle East is Israel, of course. So only democracy. In fact, Israel participates not in the Asian musical festivals, but in that great festival called Eurovision. Nobody else cares about Eurovision or what? Do you know what Eurovision is?
Yes.
Before American Idol, it was the best show. But Americans never watched it. You get to see these Lithuanians or whatever singing in English or somebody singing in French. Pop song, I think that's how ABBA broke through. My friend Sri wrote in a tweet that he was listening to ABBA in his car. I said, please don't say things like that. It makes Indians of our age look bad. because you reveal what we actually listen to, you know. But this old story, the second lesson, the old story is that the only democracy in the Middle East is Israel. So the narrative very quickly was, we had been trying to put pressure on them to become democratic for the last 50 years. We had been putting pressure on Mubarak. We had been pressuring him, showing him how to do it, etc. In fact, they put so much pressure on Mubarak that when Tahrir Square was filled to the brim and ready to explode, and after the gangsters had come in and smashed people on the head, after all that, the United States sent my old friend Frank Wisner Jr., who I write a fair amount about, they sent him as the envoy to go and chat with Mubarak. And in the public statement, they say the following great line, maybe it's the best line from the American authorities at the time, they say, Frank Wisner Jr. is going to consult with Mubarak about a transition, and he has also spoken to the Saudis. And I think that is basically like going up to your favorite vegetarian friend and asking them where to buy a steak. Because there is no way that anybody in the Arab world is going to take a statement like that with credibility, that the Saudis are going to proctor Mubarak to democracy. Second lesson is, indeed, that actually the opposite is true. The United States has been committed to these so-called pillars of stability. And the main pillar of stability was the neoliberal security state, which included the Egyptian state, which included the Tunisian state, and it included the Libyan state as well. This may surprise some of you, and maybe you'd like to fight with me about it, but it also included the Syrian state. Because some of you may remember that during the extraordinary rendition program, when prisoners were, I don't know what the word is, rendited? No, when they were rendited. Remember how Bush used those phrases? They'd talk about, I'm going to recreate. So when you rendited somebody, they rendited people to Libya. And this goes back before 9/11, where the Americans used the torture cells in Libya to torture people captured in Afghanistan or previously in Chechnya. You'd capture somebody in Chechnya, and they'd bring them to Libya, and they would torture them. But how many of you remember Mahar Arar? Remember him? He was caught in JFK. He's a Canadian national from Syria, Canadian Syrian. He was deported not to Canada. He was deported to Damascus, where he was brutalized in those prisons. So the United States, CIA, MI5 in Britain, everybody of them used these national security neoliberal states to their full advantage. Forget trying to democratize. Second lesson, there was no attempt to so-called push them towards democracy by the United States government. That is a big lie. They had these big factors of stability, and Mubarak was a leading player in there. That is why the United States Exchequer bribed the Egyptian military to not go and threaten Israel. And that allowed Israel to disproportionately smash the Palestinians and Lebanese after 1967, because they knew there was no Arab army that could put a check on Israel's ability to have asymmetrical domination of Palestinians. And that is because the American government bribed the Egyptian army to stand down. So we have been culpable since 1967 in every major assault on the Palestinian population. Because we paid for the Egyptians to take their army offline, it emboldened Tel Aviv to act with disproportionate violence against the Palestinians. Second lesson, there was never an attempt to democratize in the Middle East. Third lesson of the book that I tried to bring out is that Gaddafi, he lost his mind in the 80s. Too many people in our side of the thing have romantic ideas of Gaddafi, even today of the Assad family. You'd have to be insane to believe that anybody should be allowed into the camp of the left who is willing to fire on civilians. The camp of the left cannot allow in its team any army that is put to fire on civilians. That to me is a bottom line. Whether there is some contradictions involved, whatever it is, if a government fires like that against its people, that government has to be condemned. And it's maybe a question of scale. You know, when you start killing thousands, at some point the litmus test has to turn you against them. Recently, the Syrian government had arrested somebody I know, a Marxist Palestinian, 57 years old. He had spent 10 years in Assad's jails in the 1990s. He was rearrested a few days ago, about 10, 12 days ago. He was held in prison, secret prison, for 10 days. On the Nakba Day, 64th anniversary of the Nakba, the Syrian authorities deported a Palestinian Marxist to Jordan. Okay, think of the symbolism of that. When he arrived in Jordan, he showed the images, 57 years old, lacerated skin, bruise marks, electrocution. This is the state of national security. These are not people to champion. Gaddafi is a complicated character. I tried to give the story, quite a detailed story in a way, of Gaddafi before the 1980s and the Gaddafi after. The Gaddafi after the 1980s is the enemy of the Gaddafi before. Because it's the same body doesn't mean it's the same soul. We all know that from watching, say, Christopher Hitchens, people like that. Their bodies get snatched. God knows you don't recognize them. You know, who are these people? One day they are attacking the government from the left. The next day they are attacking the left from the far right. I mean, I don't recognize them. People can switch. That doesn't mean you look at Gaddafi in 2009 and say, but in 1969 he was such a beautiful guy. He was like a young god when he rode into Benghazi and captured the radio station. And nobody opposed him because King Idris was such a jerk. And Gaddafi was this heroic figure. And he was a heroic figure from 69 to maybe 87, 88, somewhere around there. But then he pivots. And then you get the same kind of national security neoliberal state, which he hands over to this clique of Libyan diasporics, led by his son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. If Saif al-Islam had a different last name than Gaddafi, he would have led the rebellion against his father. Family ties held him back. His closest associates were Jibril, Shokri Ghanem, all these scoundrels who then become the Benghazi section. The final lesson of my book, and then we can start chatting, the final lesson is, why did NATO enter? And personally, I wanted to give an account to my friends. This is why I wrote the book, so I can explain to my friends why in February and March of 2011 I was saying, I'm totally opposed to intervention. And a lot of my friends were saying, but there's a genocide going to happen. Okay, unfortunately, I came on Democracy Now. Horrible experience. I thought we were just going to have a conversation. Turned out it was a debate with Juan Cole. And Amy and Juan Cole were pressuring me. There's going to be a genocide. What would you do to save them? I was like, I'm a college professor. I mean, just, you know, like this is above my pay grade, but I know that it's more, the problem here is more complicated. Sending NATO in is not, it's not going to clarify the situation. Why was I thinking that? Why? Because as I go in the book and detail, within days, one third of Libya was lost to Gaddafi. Within days. Gaddafi lost the principal working class district in Tripoli, Tajura, was gone to Gaddafi. He had lost control of it. Today in Syria, it is a totally different situation. You cannot compare Libya and Syria. In Libya, entire battalions were defecting to the rebellion. The Air Force Command Wing in Sirte defected to the rebellion. They bombed a Gaddafi a ship, some kind of ship, I don't remember, didn't say actually what, some ship in the Gulf of Sidra in late February. Libya was lost to Gaddafi. You know that chatter that Al Jazeera has just released? I don't know if you listen, it's very interesting. It reminded me a lot of the conversation in the Saddam High Command, which you can read. The National Defense University has the transcripts of that. They taped everything, you know, Saddam taped everything. And there are these conversations the night before, January 23rd, 24th, 25th. I remember because I was demonstrating in Delhi Plaza, 25th, 26th, somewhere there. They are sitting, Haman, this culture minister, very close guy to Saddam, and they're saying, when are the Russians going to help? What are the Soviets doing? Paranoid, bizarre ideas. Gaddafi, we're going to kill them all, the rats. crazy guy. He had lost the plot completely. I also knew he had lost the plot because in January, when I write a little bit about that, when Ben Ali goes, Gaddafi goes on Libyan state TV, and that is a very humorous speech because he talks about, he says, he gives his speech, he goes on and on rambling, and he keeps calling WikiLeaks Kleenex. He says, what is this Kleenex? What is this Kleenex? So, I mean, you know, come on, I to some extent sympathize with that. You know, I've encountered modern technology and said, what is this thing? But still, he had lost control. Why did NATO enter? And that's the story that's at the heart of my book. So if you are interested in why NATO entered, and therefore why we have to go, please God, let us be at least 10,000 people on Sunday. If we are less than 10,000, we are going to be killed. If we are 4, 5, 3,000, we are going to be massacred. They are going to test out every single machine they have brought on 3, 4,000 people. If they're 10, 12,000, maybe they'll be okay. Maybe they'll stop with tear gas. But so the reason we need to go is that NATO has a very cynical, deeply disturbing agenda. And it had nothing to do with freedom for Libyans. It was not also only about oil. There was a politics here, and that politics is very disturbing. How's that? To start. Okay. Okay.
This can be.
Oh, okay. So, Vijay, why don't we start then where you left off, which is to talk about how to look more at that cynicism precisely. Because I think one of the things that's very powerful in this book, I just read through it the last couple of days, is how important it is to read NATO's intervention in the context of a whole confluence of different interests, different forces, the actions of the Arab League on the one hand, the calculations in relation to other regimes that have long histories, in the case of Libya, in relation to it, and the ways in which different sorts of alignments of popular movements, revolutionary movements, did and did not coalesce during that period. So can we explore that cynicism a little bit more in terms of thinking about what was not attended to in terms of reading events from February, say, till the late spring or early summer in 2011 in Libya?
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad in the car coming over here, we started to talk about Manning Marable's biography. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I remember reading about the method they used was that they made a day-by-day accounting. What did Manning, what did Malcolm X do on 23rd of January, this date, 24th of January? I did the same kind of thing when I first started thinking about why the intervention. So I made like a scrapbook. What happened 2011? Let's bracket, because the social histories of the past will reappear in 2011. Mm-hmm. So just if you take what happens in February 15th, why does the Gaddafi regime arrest three human rights activists? Why are they doing it? Who are they? The most famous is Fateh Terbil. Mm-hmm. Why did they arrest him? What is his story? Why was this, you know, lawyer, middle-class lawyer from Benghazi, why was he defending the Islamists? Mm-hmm. He is himself not an Islamist. Then it takes you backwards to 1996. Why did the Gaddafi-era troops, led by Abdullah Sansusi, open fire inside the prison and kill 1,200 people in Abu Salim? Mm-hmm. They killed the prisoners in there. Why in 2006, when protesters in Benghazi were protesting outside the Italian embassy, bizarre choice, about the Danish cartoon controversy.
Well, partly because the Italian minister was wearing a shirt with that cartoon on.
And the reference to Italian colonialism. Mm-hmm. Huh? So they were protesting there, and Terbil was representing the families. How did the link come between the middle class, upwardly mobile to some extent, but suffocated by the lack of opportunities in that state, make a link with the Islamists. So they arrested preemptively on 15th February because they had promised on 17th February to have the 5th-year anniversary protest for the shooting during the 2006 February 17th Danish cartoon controversy in Benghazi. This was directly not related to Tunisia or to Egypt. They had planned the 17th February demonstration anyway. It hearkened to a different history as well. Of course, it gets swept in the... So in that way, when one looks at the everyday, all these social histories come alive. And I found that fascinating. I found fascinating why certain areas broke off from control faster than others. Why the Nafusa Mountains? Why did they basically cut ties with the regime and the troops had to leave there? You know, Gaddafi has had a contradictory relationship with the peoples of the mountains. You know, for a very long period, just like the Turks have a relationship with the people of the mountains, that is the Kurds, Iraqis have a problem, the Algerians had a problem. You know, they call the people Berbers. They call themselves, what is it, Amazigh, you know. I mean, Gaddafi used to go up into those mountains and give speeches saying, you are Arabs, don't lie to yourself. You know, don't speak your ridiculous language. And this was all printed in the Gaddafi papers. So it's not, somebody this morning told me, why are you making things up? You would never have given that speech. I said, well, I mean, it's in the state paper, I'm not inventing it. You know, still, but the social histories get enlivened by that. And I thought, when you can take the time to do that, you can fill in the stories that are not there in the news.
The social histories are very, very important, and we have to come back to it just thinking about the occasion, why we're here, what we're seeking to do, and to continue to do. But there's also something, in a sense, not beyond the social history, but impacting the social history from other places. And that, you know, that is both a kind of broad geopolitics and, in a certain sense, a concentrated geopolitics. And so I guess, in a sense, the question that I was asking in part is asking how we think about this period from February to March to April to May in terms of all that people, by and large, knew absolutely nothing about in this country. What, for instance, is the nature of the African Union's proposal to intervene? What are the kind of countervailing information, sources of information, about what actually were the level of casualties? Not in any way to excuse what Gaddafi and his regime did in the same sort of way that we would think about Syria and a number of other areas today, but in order to understand proportionality in terms of whether or not there was a justification to speak about a military intervention there.
I mean, here, one thing I enjoyed is I have a side career as a journalist. So I spent a lot of time last year going and interviewing people in the UN. And I've been, I talked to the Indian ambassador, I talked to the Russian consulate, I mean the UN mission. I was interested, why did X vote for this and not for this, and why did, you know, sometimes that world is utterly cut off from the rest of us. We hear the following: the UN Security Council has voted X. Or we hear the Russians have vetoed Y. But we don't hear, how was that sausage put together? Okay, let me give you an even worse one. We hear the Arab League called for intervention. Now, how many of you people know how many countries in the Arab League? 22, correct. How many people were at the meeting in Cairo that voted, that were at the meeting to vote for intervention? 11. Half of them were there, quorum. 11. Seven of them were from the Saudi Arabian...
The Gulf Cooperation Council.
Yeah, the Gulf Cooperation Council. So they delivered the Arab League. Why does this happen? There was an Arab League meeting in Baghdad recently. Again, only 11 came. But the opposite 11. Only the Kuwaitis came. None of the other Gulf people came. Why? They're angry at Iraq. Because Iraq is allowing planes to go from Iran to Syria. So they didn't come. The Arab League is a deeply divided organization. So I was interested, as you said, I was interested, when we take these diplomatic things as given, if you just open it out, it's very revealing what's going on. You know, who is doing what? Why did South Africa vote with the resolution to intervene in Libya when they had told India, Russia, China that they were also going to abstain? You know, what was the logic? Why did the Russians and Chinese not veto the resolution? So I was very interested in the details here. I mean, in a way, this looks like inside baseball of the UN. But it also tells you how geopolitics is shaped, how big interests try to put themselves forward, how they constrain themselves. And it also told me a great deal about how the United States hides behind NATO. You know, we utilize NATO basically as a front cover, because you don't have to go for congressional approval. You can say it's not a war. You can say you're doing it multinationally, etc. I found that very interesting, how the Saudis essentially made it a multilateral war. Mm-hmm. When if they had gone to the General Assembly for a vote, mm-hmm. it would have been, you know, 180 to 8. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. so that is part of it. And that was just an opportunity to talk about some of the complex relations in North Africa and the Gulf. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. the role of the Bahrain rebellion with the Libyan uprising. You know, who gave permission to the Jazeera force to cross the causeway from Saudi Arabia into Manama and crush the rebellion? Mm-hmm. Who gave that green light? And why was that acceptable? Then who gave the green light to have drone attacks against the protesters in Yemen? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when a drone kills six people and they say it killed six militants, suddenly when they're dead, they look like militants.
Or we can scale yeah. this up even and talk about the fact that while the United States might be seen as using the cover of NATO in relation to these actions, in no way, shape, or form was the United States in back of NATO in relation to the actual NATO action. And that's something that I think your book does a tremendous job in terms of chronicling. What specifically was the civilian death count in relation to thinking about these bombings? What were the different instances in which, you know, targeted campaigns were meant to terrorize cities rather than to target the Libyan armed forces? And I wondered if you could say a little bit more of that, because that's also something that we know relatively more about the ways in which this is operated, say, in Afghanistan or Iraq. But this is a story that was very difficult to get.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing is, it's amazing when you go back in a sober mood, when you're not in the middle of the debate, you know, should we intervene? Firstly, it's kind of an absurd thing. Like, what is the left's opinion about military intervention into a country? As if we have any, like, power to define, you know, all you have is, do you want to give it the left's imprimatur, like a blessing, or you deny the blessing? Like, Samantha Power, we bless you, or Samantha Power, we don't bless you. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of kind of odd sense that we actually matter, you know. But still, in the cold light of day, when you go back and look, and I spent some time, I'll come to the actual mm-hmm. bombing raids, but just to go back to, was it a genocide question? I asked all my friends who said that intervention was imperative, what was their source of information? Mm-hmm. And so people said, well, this or that or this or that. Well, what was this or that? This or that? Well, some of it was Al Jazeera. What was Al Jazeera? Al Jazeera was not claiming they had their own sources. Okay, let's come back to that in a minute. The head of the United Nations was saying in press conferences that press reports are telling him that a genocide is imminent. Which press report? Excuse me, Secretary General, which press report? Nobody asked him. Robert Gates, the head of the American military, how much does the American government give to the military per year? How many trillions of millions of billions of dollars? Some gazillion dollars,
enough,
whatever?
Enough to find enough out information money? Right. on the ground.
What does Gates say at three different occasions? He says, press reports indicate. I'm like, you have the CIA, you have the military intelligence, you have drones, you have... You know, every third person I know is a spy, you know. mm-hmm. Press reports, which press report? Well, it turns out it was one organization that through its relentless campaign pushed the numbers, and that was Al Arabiya. Now, if you know anybody who takes Al Arabiya seriously, you have to check them into a mental institution. Because Al Arabiya is owned by the Hariri family of Lebanon. And it's owned by a kind of a slim branch of the more decrepit elements of the Saudi royal bloodline. But the Hariris are the controlling interests. Now, if you know anything about Beirut, which is, I think, one of my favorite cities in the world, the Hariris have ruined that city. I don't know how many of you know Beirut at all, but on the Corniche, you could actually walk down the thing. It was beautiful. Now there are these gigantic, ugly buildings And the thing you should do is, if you're ever in Beirut, go along that waterway at about 9 o'clock at night, and the whole building is dark. Because these are all apartments owned by people who live in Riyadh or somewhere. They come for a weekend, they have their lover coming from somewhere, they meet them in the apartment. They've ruined the whole front of the water. Okay, they own, this is their media company. They were tweeting, this is where the Americans come in. They were tweeting, 10,000 wounded, Misrata, 20,000 potential today, 8,000 dead. Okay. Investigation subsequently, 200 killed, 85% men. If you see 80% men, it's not quite indiscriminate violence. Now, this is not saying that Gaddafi wasn't shelling into the city. Certainly shelling into Misrata, certainly into Zintan, shelling into the city. Brutal, barbaric actions. But it was not genocidal. Okay, fine. They talk like that, these men. He'll say, let's erase that city. You know, it's like Mladic. Mm-hmm. I quoted Mladic in there. Mladic said, you know, we're going to erase the city, or some line. We're going to make them so they have nightmares. We're going to bomb them till they have nightmares in their next life. I mean, he was a thug. You know, Mladic, thug guy. But that doesn't mean that you're capable of enacting your thuggishness. Mm-hmm. It's not that easy to raise a city, you know, especially not if you have if you don't have full command of bombers. They're shelling in, look at Homs, they shell non-stop, and 800 dead here, 1,000 dead here, today 20 dead. I think 20 dead, my God, the images you see, you'd think 10,000 died today. It's not that easy to just wipe out a city. It takes time, it takes dedication, it takes brutality. Gaddafi had those things, but he didn't have time. He was losing the country. So the numbers are interesting. Now, if the numbers on one side were 300 here, 200 there, 400, if you add it all up, okay. What if we discover that the NATO bombing killed comparable numbers of civilians? Then we have a moral problem. How do you morally justify military intervention to prevent the killing of civilians when you end up in your action killing an equivalent number of civilians? Okay, forget that. Forget equivalent. Do you allow 50% of the number of civilians to be killed? Is that okay? So if 2,000 civilians killed and 2,000 potential, let's say 4,000, you end up killing 2,000. Is that okay? Is it okay to kill 1,000? I mean, what is the proportionality of civilians to be killed? NATO has refused to allow an investigation. And that is my greatest complaint of all the member state governments, is that what we have essentially allowed is we have allowed NATO to become an unaccountable military dictatorship. And that is inexcusable. It has no oversight.
On that point, you have a very interesting quote on page 197 of the book where you speak about Libya and you term it, and I think I have the words right here, the first battleground of the new Cold War, which is not between the US and Russia, but between the G7 and its military arm NATO and the BRICS, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and other emerging non-Western nations who do not have much of a military arm. Can you say a little bit more about that in light of this problem, of the what this demonstrates about the inability to keep a military apparatus like NATO in account over time, but particularly now?
I mean, this is the question of our time, in a way. And in fact, they have to ask that question because they're going broke. You know, the New York Times had a great article on NATO where they said Europe is not ready for prime time. You know, the Europeans are stupid. Americans spend 4.6% of our GDP in military. Silly Europeans, they only spend 1.6%. They are not ready for prime time. This is a direct quote from the Times. It was from the editorial. Okay, prime time, they're not ready. Because they don't spend enough money on the military. Okay? NATO is basically an American operation. The Europeans are not willing to sustain it. They want the idea of it. They'll give the free land in Brussels. They'll give you some sophisticated European to be the Secretary General. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, I don't know how many of you saw his piece in the Tribune today. I like Chicago beer. I'm looking forward to coming to Chicago and having the beer. I mean, what the hell was that doing in the op-ed on NATO? Did you see this?
I didn't see
it. It was essentially NATO washing. You know, we're just another meeting. It's like there's a truck convention, and then there's a NATO convention.
But when you go up Lakeshore Drive, it says NATO events are going to cancel rather than the
right.
NATO summit, rather than an emergency hard
yeah.
perimeter that the military is setting up.
This is like, you know, it's a big concert. They're going to have fun there. 10,000 people coming. So Europe plays a role, but it's not essential. Now, you see, when the United Nations Security Council makes a resolution which says all member states should do X, Y, Z, should protect civilians in Libya, the UN can produce the legitimization for action. But right now, only the Americans or the Americans through NATO can execute. I mean, do you think the Chinese are going to bring their one aircraft carrier, put it off the coast of Libya, send off the... the Chinese have never done anything like that. You know, the closest they've come to is they're fooling around little war games in the Straits of Taiwan. You know, they're not capable. Are the Russians capable? Totally not. One aircraft carrier sits in off the port in, what is it, not Latakia, it's the other one, in Syria. One aircraft carrier, then they don't have the force projection. They cannot do it. They don't have the logistical ability. They'll run out of gas. So what we're saying essentially is we still have a situation where India, China, all these countries are growing exponentially faster. China is going, not the largest economy in the world, but it's going to be the largest GDP in the world. You know, economic activity is slightly different because our... we are higher standard of living, all that stuff. Anyway, but China's economic powerhouse, India is growing at this year maybe 6.3%. These countries are growing, the economic. So they are putting dibs on the IMF. Why don't we have our leader on the World Trade Organization? You know, they want to have Asian leaders, African leaders in these things. Okay. But they are not capable of saying, we want to have what the UN had discussed in 1940s, a military commission of the UN. If there is ever a resolution under Article 7 of the UN Charter, which authorizes military force, let the military of the UN act. That was a discussion in the 50s. In the 50s, neither the Russians nor the Americans wanted this. So they deep-sixed it. Today, we need to say, close down NATO, make the UN peacekeeping force more robust. You know, make them better equipped.
And trust some of these other regional associations to actually be able to come in and mediate rather than to intervene, which I think is also a lesson in terms of thinking about Libya. Two more questions, and then I know that a number of people have questions and we want to open this up in terms of discussion. One is that I think a lot of us are here for this discussion. A lot of us are here in relation to coming out on Sunday in terms of the actions against NATO to make a point about geopolitics. But I think a lot of us, and in many cases, many of us also are here to make a point about the economics of geopolitics and the fact that devoting the kinds of, you know, treasure and blood in relation to these kinds of actions is something that takes away from the capacity to be able to provide basic services in relation to one's peoples. That the ways in which one uses the military arm to hoard and concentrate resources and hoard and concentrate opportunities for investment, for expropriation, is something that exacerbates the kinds of, you know, fundamental economic inequalities that one sees. And rather than go back over all of the ground related to Egypt, to Libya, and maybe even some of the other states, I guess I would ask you to sort of meditate a little bit on how we can take some of these lessons and take them into the ways in which we're trying to create better links between understanding how the geopolitics of an organization like NATO impacts our capacity to address the kinds of questions of privatization, neoliberalism, austerity, that relate to both policies here and increasingly policies in other areas of the world.
I mean, that's a big...
Take a step.
That's a big question. I mean, I know exactly what our biggest impediment is in the United States to coming at that question. I mean, I think thus far in our politics, in our visions, in the categories we have in the United States, the categories we have, okay, let me give you a slogan that we use, right? There's a guy in my hometown, Tyler Boudreau, who's a veteran of the Iraq War. And Tyler says, I don't like the phrase, bring the troops back home. Okay, he says, I don't like that. I don't want to bring the troops home, he says. He says, I want to bring the people back home. But I don't want the troops to come back because I don't want our cities to be military encampments. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I hate that slogan, bring the troops back home. So I remember chatting with him. I thought this was a very insightful point he was making, that we are lazy in our sloganeering. Bring the troops back home. No, bring people back home. Disband the troops. But there's another aspect to that. So our capacity to understand anti-militarism is bring the troops back home, okay, bring the people back home, bring the Americans back home. But it's okay, drone attacks, it's okay to have bases, it's okay to have ships, you know, in every single sea have American boats. It's okay to go to a movie theater in Seoul and see these three Americans carrying guns come in and sit next to you watching a movie. Can you imagine going to watch a movie in Chicago and there are these three fellows from the People's Liberation Army of China with their weapons sitting there watching the movie with it? It's a freaky thought, you know? But it's American, it's totally normal around the world. Okay, so what we don't have is a concept of imperialism. We have a concept of too much military spending. We have a concept of don't send our people to die overseas. But we don't have a concept of imperialism. For instance, okay, don't send troops overseas. What about sending John Timoney, who brutalized Philadelphia as police chief, brutalized Miami. How many of you were there in FTAA Miami? Most scary demo ever. Second, Pittsburgh, correct? Who was in Pittsburgh? Nobody. G20 Pittsburgh, terrifying. But FTAA, you were there? You remember that? I thought I was in Baghdad. Tear gas. Tanks, no, not tanks, but those like semi-tank vehicles, the shield on their face. I mean, it was like a war game. Mm-hmm. Timoney, from all these, where is he now? He is training the police force in Bahrain. Wow. So, we are an imperialist country. Even though the economy is in crisis, there is an imperialist advantage. Because we are an imperialist country, we are able to maintain the dollar as the central currency to denominate, you know, maximum denomination of oil, most commodities is in dollar. That means the United States can still run up deficits. Unlike the Greeks, poor bloody Greeks, colonized by the Germans. You know, we can run up deficits. We have massive social inequalities in our society. But yet, there are these small advantages of, for instance, production of weaponry. Every single state has factories that produce arms. In Tahrir Square, people are saying, Obama, you came here, you said, I'm going to reach out a hand, please don't meet it with a fist. That was his famous line. And they held up the tear gas Canada made in the USA. Mm-hmm. So we are selling arms all over the world. So unless we come to terms with the idea of imperialism, it actually hurts us. Mm-hmm. Because why? We allow, in our society, the economy to be semi-stabilized by military spending. Mm-hmm. That's how we stabilize the US economy. When there is a downturn, instead of doing counter-cyclical spending in the social sector, we do it in the military sector. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't help us, this imperialism. But because we don't get it, people are scared, saying if you close down the factory that makes tear gas, we'll be all unemployed. Well, why instead of tear gas, why do we allow our brightest engineers to go A, into the weapons industry, and B, to Wall Street to design derivatives? Mm-hmm. You know, unless we bring the concept imperialism home and understand the system for what it is, our fear of converting this economy into a human-based economy is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. Because people right now are terrified. If you cut military spending, if you cut factories that produce arms, we will be broke. Because that's our main manufactured export, is weapons to the rest of the world.
Right, right.
And unless we absorb that, we are going nowhere.
Right. Well, hard to do when domestically you're willing to keep up prisons precisely in order
exactly
to be able
the
to
same
have
logic.
People hired.
Yes.
There. My last question, and then we'll go into a general discussion. This is a hard book in a lot of ways, and I think there's a move to really say that the sort of the fervor, the energy, the optimism that came out of Egypt has to be contextualized in relation to what you call the Libyan winter. But I think there's also a larger theoretical point, and it's not at all an abstract theoretical point. It's a really fundamental one, and I think it comes back to this question of trying to get people to think right about moments of revolution. I mean, this is a moment of revolution that's happening. But particularly, I did read the end as we were sitting down.
Oh, good.
Particularly at the end, in a lot of ways, what you're saying is that there is no revolution without counter-revolution. We cannot understand the pace and the course and the progress of revolution without paying close attention to the ways in which counter-revolutionary forces are always operating. And perhaps a little bit more, if you could say, about how we have, you know, both the breadth of mind and the courage to be able to acknowledge that even as we work for fundamental change, we have to be very clear and very, you know, very, very frank about understanding what it is that we're operating against, as well as what it is that we are trying to seek in relation to our work.
I mean, this the best example is in the United States. It's not in Egypt. And that's the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you allow any major advance to be celebrated in a one-dimensional way, mm-hmm. as an advance, mm-hmm. and then to be memorialized, to have roads named, to have museums built, and not acknowledge...
To believe that it's become part of the establishment rather than something that the establishment is fighting against.
Exactly. Because when they make the museum, they are making a statement about how you should see that history. Mm-hmm. Because their power, their sinews of domination morph. You know, one thing... Just to take it back to Egypt, one thing that happens in any revolution, actually, whatever the revolutionary condition, when the revolution is, there's no revolution that's ever total. Humans are stubborn. We have our own imagination. When you are growing up, you say, I'll never be like my parents. And then lo and behold, you look in the mirror and go, oh my God, that gesture, you know, that thing that irritated you, that thing, the hand in the face, all these things come back. In the same way with society, culture is a very conservative force. It pulls you back. You know, you had the women's movement, you had people saying, we're never going to be like our parents. 20 years later, what's happening in the house? Excuse me, I thought we had a feminist movement, and now why am I doing the cooking, and why am I going half-time in my job, and why are you continuing your career like nothing has changed? Culture is a very conservative force. It's, you know, we always think we'll always move faster than culture. Politics moves faster than culture. In revolutions, when you look at counter-revolutionary forces typically take refuge in tradition. Because they know the pace of tradition is so much slower than the pace of legislation or the pace of, you know, and that is their great advantage. And unless we study carefully how counter-revolutionary forces mobilize, what terrains they seek to hold on to, you know, why is it that they will go to culture often? You know, in the United States, they go to culture, nostalgia, a kind of coded American culture thing will develop, an industry develops. You know, why you go to culture? You go to culture, you start talking about religion more, etc., whatever, these things. Why? Because there you can sit on this slow-moving boat and try to expand its power back into society. And you see that, for instance, in North Africa, because the Qataris are funding the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis are funding the Al-Nur party in Egypt, for instance. I mean, in Tunisia, it's amazing. The Nahda party returns from exile. They show up in Tunis. And in a fancy district of Montplaisir, they buy a huge building. Where the hell did they get the money to buy this big building? You'll have all these trade unions, all these people that lived and died in the revolution. They didn't buy a building. Where's their building? You know, where's the independent tax workers authority of Egypt, which is one of the largest unions in Egypt, the most bizarre name for a union. It's like comes out of some kind of modern novel, you know, the tax workers union. They're state employees, you know, tax, because they work for taxes. There's a tax workers union. So why didn't they get a building? They didn't get a building, but the Brotherhood got this huge office. So there's a way in which the counter-revolution will come through new social forces, political forces. But they come in the direction of culture. So the broad theoretical point is, if you don't attend to the forces of counter-revolution, they will memorialize Tahrir Square, and everything will go back to normal. New faces will appear. In fact, that was the position of the Facebook champions. Weil's book, for instance, argues that, you know, Tahrir was great, but Egyptians should go back to work now. Mm-hmm. You know, we overthrew Mubarak. That's what we wanted. We wanted to overthrow Mubarak. Mubarak is gone. Let's have elections. Go back to work, lazy Egyptians. That's basically his book. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is the book of the counter-revolution. Because what the people are actually saying is, this society needs to be transformed. No more should people be sleeping in graveyards. You know, why should one entire area, Heliopolis, be these massive mansions with huge lawns, and meanwhile you have entire families in a tomb? That's what they want to change. Mm-hmm. Because theirs was a revolution against Mubarak as much as against his son, who embodied neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't attend to the counter-revolutionary processes, you miss what the revolution has gained and what it's failed to gain.
Right. Let's open it up in terms of questions. Over here.
Would you say something about Gaddafi's Pan-African ambitions and about the fallout of the NATO intervention on sub-Saharan Africa?
I mean, you know, Gaddafi is an interesting character. Mercurial is the phrase of the day. You know, everybody liked to use that phrase to talk about him, but this is a good phrase. You know, Gaddafi first tried, he has an interesting foreign policy history. You see him first creating this organization of Islamic Revolution in the 70s. In 71, I think he creates this. He tries that out, you know, making alliances on the platform of Islam. If you actually read the Green Book is not, it's a very anti-communist book. It's very much this third way of Islam, kind of a Ali Shariati, if Ali Shariati never read anything. You know, it's that kind of account. You know, it's that sort of position that he stakes out. So he first tries this Islam line. That doesn't work. Then he tries a pan-Arab thing, you know, brother leader, the Arab thing. In there, as Arab nationalism involutes, but Gaddafi started to pick fights with all the Arab leaders. The most famous was in 2009 when he insulted the Saudi king.
Right.
You know, that's a historic thing. I mean, the things, you can read, the things he says to him. I quote the thing. He finds he has lost the Arab world. Then he pivots for a third time to Africa. Now, to be honest with you, there's a contradictory thing in this whole Pan-African dream. It was Pan-African, but it was also Libya in Africa. It was also paternalistic. It was also Gaddafi showing up to the meeting in Lusaka, buying houses for each one of the leaders of the African states, you know, building houses. It was also, I am the great benefactor of Africa. It was a little troubling to me. Now, it is also true that there was, because things are contradictory, there was an advantage, which meant he also had then this promotion of people of dark skin. Okay, he promoted. Meanwhile, again, another contradiction. He told Berlusconi, I'm going to do two things for you. One, the oil will flow and the immigrants will stay. That means Libya acted as a check to prevent sub-Saharan African migration to Europe. That was the whole Lampedusa thing. You know, they met there and Gaddafi gave a speech saying we're going to not allow illegal immigration across the Mediterranean. So I just want to put in context, it was a deeply contradictory Pan-Africanism. It was not a people-centered Pan-Africanism. It was like a little boy playing chess. Didn't work with these pieces on this side, let me try out the knight on the right. I never took that seriously, because I found it a little paternalistic.
We won't talk about his love letters to Condoleezza Rice.
That is
Barbara?
The best scrapbook.
Mass work, which is not so much that it's not just the state with cops and guns preventing people from realizing the kind of society that we would envision and imagine, but there are a lot of other things that do that too, and some of them cultural and very complicated. So I guess I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that dynamic between kind of a mass uprising against something, and you compared to civil rights movement, is, I mean, it was an uprising in a sense, a protest, a number of protests and movements against Jim Crow segregation and all this. It wasn't necessarily a movement for socialism or a radically different kind of society. So there's a struggle within the struggle around that, and it's not, you know, and it's a struggle between people who might, in the final analysis, agree, right? So I guess I wanted to ask you to complicate the narrative about what the mass uprising represented for those of us who try to organize in a different context with similar contradictions.
I mean, there was no mass. There is no such thing as a mass. There are complicated social factions that were involved. You know, there were the trade unions. Just to give a sense first of the social scale, there were the liberals, the Al-Nur type people, Al-Ghad people, sorry. Ayman Nur was one of the leaders, the liberal type people. There were the Islamists. I'll come back to them in a minute.
Well, when I say the mass, I'm talking about the people who weren't necessarily affiliated, or the interstitial kind of forces between all of that.
There was that. But there were a lot of organized people. There was April 6th movement, there was March 23rd movement, there was Kefia, there was this, there was, you know. By the time you disaggregate these organized, and these people didn't come from disciplined, cadre-based organizations. They came from mass mobilized movements. You know, so like these movements are anti-Iraq war, that's how that mobilization took place. So just to give a sense that it was a very, they were not people just saying, let's go and meet in Tahrir Square. That happens later, I think. Because remember, almost 2,000 people were killed in this revolution. This was not a peaceful revolution. So it took a lot of courage to go in there. That means you had to, not just in Tahrir Square, but in Alexandria, in Port Said, in Suez, in all these places, the uprising, the center, they were dangerous. People were taking risks. Let me just talk about the risk for a minute and then I'll come back to the contradictions. One thing that's really important, the lesson that I learn over and over again, is that as historians, when we look back at, say, the 1930s, 1940s, and you read about, say, communist militants, you know, these were people who said, history is on our side. The revolution is going to come in 10 years. Therefore, I am going to sacrifice everything. I'm even willing to give my life for this movement. I'm going to break my ties with my friends. I'm going to go insane doing my organizing, you know, nonstop. Today, on the left, we are a little less insane. We say, it's not going to happen. I'll make some compromise. I'll work, okay, not 18 hours a day, 12 hours a day, or 8 hours a day. Do I want to die for this revolution? We're going on Sunday, if they start shooting bullets, I'm going to run away, you know, those are things. Now, in Tahrir, you did have people who said, we can die for this. And I remember, this I saw photographs of, a video of, when the camel riding thugs came into the square, a line formed to block them. So I took some photographs and showed my friends, you know, I asked them, who are these people? Were they just, most of them were the Brotherhood. Yes, these guys are deeply trained, organized. They are willing to die. Now, I don't have any truck with the Islamist movement or anything, but there is something that they have an eschatology. They are living with a vision that they might win, similar to what the left used to have in an earlier time. You know, will we go and stand like that now? Will we defend the crowd? Are we as brave as them? We have not had the opportunity necessarily. In Pittsburgh, everybody ran away. When the police was marching, everybody ran away. 3-4 anarchists went to confront.
But you're not making an indictment. You're making an analysis.
I'm making an analysis. I'm not judging anybody here. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that this is where we are. You know, this is where we are. This is where they were. At the same time, that level of how they understand bravery is deeply masculinized. There's a deep sense of who can be, who this revolution is for. And then you will remember that on International Women's Day, when the women said, today is our day in the square, it was a contested development. People said, no, what Women's Day? In Egyptian history, this goes back to Nasserism. This is the same debate that happened after 52. In 57, there was a debate when people said, what vision do we have for this revolution? Who is going to define it? Since we were there in 1911, that is, these women's organizations, we were there in 1911. We were getting shot at in 1911. You know, we have been part of this revolution from the 1910s. We are not coming and asking you for favors. We get to define what the... This is the same conversation that started around the International Women's Day March. That is March 6th, when they occupied Tahrir Square. So there are contradictory social visions in this. But I feel like, similar to the civil rights movement, their level of unity was extremely low. It was simply that the elections had been fraudulent. The previous election was fraudulent, and the Mubarak regime is no longer have legitimacy. That they have rigged two elections. That was the level of unity. I mean, that is the reason why the politics that follow are going to be extremely difficult. And a lot of space opens then for restoration, for the right to return somehow. Because they have given a lot of room. The trick for North Africa is going to be that the Islamists are going to come to authority. If there are genuine fair elections, they are going to come to authority. The thing is, they are not going to be capable of governing these societies. They don't have any economic policies. They will be like Hezbollah in Lebanon. They will pursue neoliberal policies. The real trick is, what happens to the rest? Are they going to sit on the side and complain? Or are they going to be ready to be the next ones to take over? Because that's going to be the test. So I don't know if there was any compelling social vision that united them. I think it was just a movement opposed. Look at Libya. I mean, in Libya, the last 10 days, there have been strikes in Benghazi, in Tripoli. The prime minister sitting in his office, the fellows from Nafusa break in and say, get out of your chair. They didn't come in the thing. They came into his office. You know, the oil production down by 20% because of the oil strikes. So the fight over how to define is going to continue for a long time. But that's not answering fully your question. I'm trying to see what...
I'm going
to
come back over here, but I just want to check, because this is actually an important point. Yeah. Do you want to say anything further, Barbara? Okay. In the back, over here, standing up. Speak up, please. It's a very direct question, so I'll leave it over to Vijay to respond to, and then I'm sure others may have thoughts about it as well.
I mean, 8 million people, I think, killed in the Congo in the last 12 years, and who were they killed by? They were killed by the entry of two of the State Department's Renaissance African leaders, right? The State Department has picked three African leaders as Renaissance African leaders, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Museveni of Uganda, and who is the head of state of Ethiopia?
Bella Samawi.
Those are the three Renaissance African leaders. Who is there in Eastern Congo leading the massacre of 8 million Congolese people over the last decade and a half. Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Joseph Museveni of Uganda. Now you think NATO is going to go and protect the Congolese from two of the State Department's Renaissance African leaders?
Over on the side. Actually, let me
come
over here.
Am I not answering anybody's questions?
Go ahead over here.
I thought that was the answer.
Please.
James, is that a good answer? Good answer?
Please.
Just checking, you know. Well, this I have done a lot of reporting about. This is where I've been in the UN for a long, long time. I was very interested in this question because it brings out some of the cynicism of United States action, NATO action in the Arab world. I mean, the short answer is they had a reason to enter Libya. That's what the story I tell you. Okay, so I won't rehearse that. In Syria, if they want the Syrian people to bleed, Syria is the most effective border guard for Israel. Okay, currently, Israel's Egyptian border is weak, as I said, this government big. Lebanon, there's been never a, you know, they don't recognize each other. There's a UN interim force which has been there since 1970-something, no more interim, but they still call themselves. The so-called border with occupied territories, it's not really a border. It's a big wall, but that's also destabilized. The only stable border has been Golan. Secondly, Syria plays a very double game with Hezbollah, in my opinion. Syria is not a friend of the Palestinians. The Palestinians, most of the sensible Palestinian organizations broke with Syria in the 1970s. Many of them had to take refuge there. If you talk to any of the PFLP, DFLP type people, they all have a very interesting take on Syria. Even Hamas has renounced the Assad regime. Israel does not want a precipitous collapse in Syria. What if the Brotherhood comes to power? It's encircled, finished. Finished. Politics will be terrible for Israel. They should be really introspecting now. How to create a new security situation with such a neighborhood where there is no chance for you to have a stable border with anybody. Okay, so Israel does not want. United States also has an anxiety. I tell you, it's a funny thing. The Syrian government, you may not remember this, but Syria joined the so-called Coalition of the Willing in 1990-91 to remove Saddam Hussein from Iraq. I don't know if you remember this, but Syria sent arms and they sent a general. You know, a few weeks ago, I was talking to a friend of mine saying, where is that general? Because that general must have remained contacts with the Americans. They may have, this guy will be a good replacement for Assad. So we investigated. He was killed. So, Americans don't have a character there. They're playing a very dirty game. People are building up both sides. That's the dangerous thing about militarism. The Saudis, Qataris are arming people. People are dying in Syria. You're building up conflict. The Russians are still sending arms to Assad. Both sides are being armed to the gill to slaughter each other. And this is like a game. They're all standing and watching. They're not going to intervene. They would prefer a destabilized Syria. That is to say, Israel would prefer a destabilized Syria than a Syria where there is some modicum of stability with a hostile government. I don't think anybody is going to try very hard. The Russian mission told me very straightforward, on the record, they said that the Americans are hiding behind us. So,
Over here, please.
Yeah, sort of spoke about beyond oil, there's sort of a confluence of geopolitical factors for why the U.S. went into Libya. And there's sort of knee-jerk intellectual political laziness on the left when we say it's all on oil. I'm curious, I mean, I'll still buy your book, but if you could delve into, just give us a little taste of what the other factors are.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay, fine. I thought you were saying something hostile, yeah.
You know what, before you answer, Vijay, let me get three questions in line so that we can actually come over. Peter, let me get a question from you. Okay, and then one more question, please. Over here.
Yeah, I actually, sorry, but I have two questions. One of which I feel.
Only one. Sorry.
Only one.
You got to choose one.
How did the story you gave a little paragraph, not a paragraph, a clause to the story, which I think is a true one, about how, as FDR we have called it, put it back to win the war, was the reason we got out of the Depression. That used to be in a form that wasn't quite so unflattering. Used to be a commonplace of the understandings of what made America succeed during the Cold War. That military counter-cyclical, even if it wasn't as good as the civil.
You'll forgive me, but I'm going to ask you to come over to just a question with this, please,
okay,
if you can.
Fine. What made it disappear? That story. No longer, used to be a commonplace, is no longer anywhere to be found. It would seem like ancient history to most people under 40. Like, what?
Thank God I'm over 40. Not very much older, okay? Don't get any ideas.
So go ahead.
Okay, let's deal with that, because the thing is, I don't know the answer why it disappeared. I can guess it may, what was it? Dot-com boom, finance, we grow because we have all these illusions that make us grow. I don't know the exact answer.
How about the end of the Cold War?
Maybe the end of the Cold War. You know, they used to talk about the peace dividend. I don't know exactly why the narrative disappeared. Why oil? That's the thing. Why and why not oil? Meaning, what is the story? I mean, from 1988, the reason Gaddafi's regime changed so dramatically was that he did a stupid thing. On the one side, you relied for your economy on oil revenue sales to the West. And there was no attempt in 20 years of the revolution to diversify the economy. 20 years you were living off oil rents, selling the oil to the West. At the same time, you started to intensify your anti-Western rhetoric. This was not a sustainable politics. And so you got smashed with a UN sanction, US sanction, etc. Within a year and a half, the Libyan economy was contracting rapidly. So Gaddafi was desperate to make a new arrangement with the West. That's when he sends Musa Khusa on his journey. And, you know, that's a great story. Okay, but the point is, by the 1990s, it was like 5 or 6 years. Total was back. Sarkozy's company was back. Berlusconi's friends all came back. The Italians were back. The Americans are the only ones who are pure. They came last. Europeans were in there first. No problem. So oil was flowing into Italy, you know, from the 90s. They were earning oil revenues again. You know, and in fact, Gaddafi, when he got angry with the oil companies, just changed their names. That I'll leave for, because that's a good detail. Mm-hmm. He just... What games, so-called nationalist games he would play. Because he was the most entertained, one of the reasons. I went to Libya, one of the most things was I always found him deeply entertaining. Also, when I came to America, I had very long hair and people used to call me Gaddafi. So but I always found him politically so bizarre. You know, always getting himself into these bizarre traps. You know, no actual political strategy, changing mind, you know, he decentralized power, he said, but in its name, he actually centralized all the power. Bizarre kind of politics, very troubling character. And he was playing with the lives of the Libyans in the middle. Of course, it's true. Somebody will say, yeah, health standards went up, literacy. Of course, firstly, you were starting from zero. Okay, the Italians were the worst colonialists in the world. Italians never tried to even impart their culture. The only Italian remnants in Libya you see, one is a little architecture, and secondly, the sweets. Italian sweets, not the cuisine. You know, but there was no colonialism. Nobody speaks Italian or sings Italian songs or anything. They were not like English or French or anything. So they started from very poor numbers. And there was an improvement in the 15 years. But oil was flowing. There was no problem. So the war wasn't about oil. That was not the reason. The war was about politics. The price was oil. New York Times in August headline was the scramble for Libya's oil. By the way, nobody uses the word scramble with Africa unconsciously. You know, it always refers to 1885. So the scramble for Libya's oil was the headline in August of last year in the New York Times. Yes, there was a prize. But don't mistake the prize for the reason for going in. The reasons I saw was much more political. The prize they always knew was going to be there was the oil. There were other economic factors. But these may not have been related directly to Libya. Some of this is related to the Gulf, the role, increasingly powerful role of the Gulf. And in that, the Saudis. You know, they are playing a very big role in world affairs, and the Qataris as well. They're not identical. They are playing a simultaneous role. The Saudis tried to create a union of all the kingdoms last week. You know, the Bahrain wants to dissolve itself into Saudi Arabia. They have been talking about this. But the Qataris will not go for this. I mean, how many of you have been to Dubai? How many of you have been to Doha? Doha, Dubai, I mean, these places, they have their own, they live in a different planet. You know, Doha, Qatar is, I mean, I was telling you, in the convention center, they have this Louis Bourgeois sculpture of the spider. You know, they are not, they don't want to be dissolved into Saudi Arabia, at least. They see themselves as open-minded more than the Saudis in comparison. There are social questions. But they are making a move in the world economy. You know, Saudi Arabia has become a linchpin in the Asian world. Increasing exports of oil to India, increasing exports of oil to China. They have their own foreign policy ambitions. They are not necessarily subordinate fully to America. They have their own games going. And they insisted on the Libyan invasion very much. The French and the Saudis in particular. You know, it's true, Americans didn't come in there forcefully. In the American government, from reporting I did, and what is there confirmed now in many, many people's retrospective, Ryan Lizza's retrospective thing on that confirms it, that there was a section in the American government wanted to intervene very early, in February. But they were reticent. The Saudis have a, why? Because they are also in a lynch. They understand that there is a shift happening in the world economy. And I think this must threaten the Americans. If the Saudis are increasing oil sales to India, China, King has gone to China, King has gone to India, what is going on here? This must be disturbing to them in Washington. That to see their pliant little gas station attendant visiting these other emerging countries, it must really disturb them.
I'm going to bring one more question in before we stop. You had your hand up.
I mean, I don't know Morocco much except that they always seem to have such enlightened kings. And they always, Mohammed IV brought in tractors and the current one allowed Facebook. I don't know much about Morocco, to be honest with you. Extraordinary rendition, they participated. They are also one of these Renaissance countries, but I don't know if they're exactly that level. They may be sort of, you know, enlightenment. country leader. But Muhammad's, you know, they are in line. I don't know enough. But Algeria is a very interesting story because Algeria started its development in the 90s. I mean, no country that goes through that kind of civil war will have the appetite to try to destabilize itself within a decade. Impossible. You know, one of the reasons why the large section of the Syrian middle class, even though they despise Assad, will not go out on the streets is that they saw what happened to Iraq. They saw the refugees cross into Syria. They are exhausted by the detritus of precipitous regime change. They are not going to relinquish Assad that easily. You know, I said earlier, in Libya, 3 days, one-third gone. In Syria, maybe 45% of the population is still with Assad. And it's not all Alawites, it's not all Christians. Some Sunni middle class also, because you know what? Regime change is inconvenient. And what does the middle class praise more than anything else? Convenience. That's how the regime gets you. They say this NATO protest will inconvenience you. So then the media will say, why are these people protesting? It's inconveniencing us. Middle class praises convenience more than ideology, more than freedom, more than anything. So in Algeria, they are exhausted. So many dead in the 90s. Such a long, brutal civil war. Crushing. It's no surprise that there was no... In fact, this election, what kind of election was it? You know, not a very impressive show of free and fair elections. But there was an election. You know, and there will not be because people just don't have the stomach for it. And we should not underestimate two things in human history. One is that people get tired. You know, people just don't have the energy to do it anymore. And the other is that, especially Marxists and all, we don't take seriously personal equations in foreign policy. Especially when you're dealing with monarchies. That the Emir of Qatar hated Gaddafi. He hates Gaddafi more than he dislikes Assad. And, you know, we think, no, no, there must be some class thing. 1 minute, there is no class thing there because he's the Emir of Qatar. He can cut anybody's head off. Okay, he can make a decision like that. Because, you know, okay, I understand, it's not hydraulic. One guy and the whole society, but I know that, I know. But he doesn't have to answer to much larger sections, etc. You know, when he decided to change the leader in Al Jazeera, there was no press coverage even on Al Jazeera. You know, later they revealed, well, how come the head of Al Jazeera has gone to do a sabbatical? Why is the new head of Al Jazeera part of the royal family? Remember this? Nobody reports, nobody questioned during the Libya war he was changed. Why was he changed? You know, so we forget the power of human exhaustion, we forget the power of cupidity, we forget the power of sheer hatred of one person to another. Why did America go into war with Iraq? Because Bush Jr. was angry that Saddam tried to kill his dad.
We'll stop there. But we'll also stop in the spirit of making sure that we don't lose our energy. Yeah. So we go through the weekend. Yeah. Vijay, thank you very much.
Thank you.